This is Fighting Bob Radio on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Eric Shubring, and we're excited to welcome you, listeners, to the program today, as we're just a day and a half away, I guess we could say, from the Fighting Bob Festival and a kickoff at the Goodman Center, and where Phil Donahue and Norman Solomon will be the featured speakers. And, of course, I'm here with our co-host Ed Garvey of FightingBob.com. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Eric. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear from you, and, boy, some exciting things. And as you write on FightingBob.com on the blog today, you've never seen anything like it.
Well, it's amazing that Mitt Romney just seems to have lost the control of his campaign. He seems to be sort of gyrating around like crazy. And for him to draft a statement while he's in the air, before he actually finds out what the facts were and the killing of the U.S. ambassador, and then to condemn the president, is just absurd. When you get the Republicans raising hell about it, I mean, here they were screaming at Romney. I think they'd rather change horses at this point than continue with Romney, but they don't have much of a chance to do that.
Well, I think they maybe. Do you think they're a bit taken back by the fact that polls are showing that Barack Obama is ahead by perhaps as many as 6 points, and they are beginning to panic?
I think they are beginning to panic, despite that wonderful convention that the Republicans had. Was that a sleeper or what?
My goodness. And then you compare it to the Democratic convention, which was, regardless of one's political persuasion or inclinations, it was well orchestrated, put together beautifully, and there were some powerful speeches. And now, of course, the concern is whether they will walk the walk or simply continue to talk the talk, if it's more than rhetoric. But if maybe the idea of still having some hope and faith and perhaps some change is a part of our future.
What I like is Romney, who now says, well, maybe some of the Obamacare we should keep. I didn't mean we were going to throw the whole thing out when all of his statements have been, day one, the first thing he's going to do is repeal Obamacare. Now he says there's some parts of it that he kind of likes. And it sort of reminds me, Paul Ryan said that he was in favor of legalizing marijuana for medicinal purposes, and that was great until the Romney campaign heard about it, and they said, no, he doesn't believe that. And Ryan said, no, I don't believe that. That's the end of that story. But Romney, what he says is just gibberish.
It's a strange step to take. He might have done better. At the same time, some are suggesting that for President Obama to step back from what seemed to have been very reasonable words out of the Cairo embassy, that not sympathizing with those who were demonstrating, if against the video of this really scurrilous, it is a nasty video. I viewed as much as I could stand of the very amateurish but very, very unpleasant depiction of Muhammad. But the statement that came out of Cairo seemed to be a very, very measured and a good one by my lights, and yet...
Well, this is a very complicated issue, for heaven's sake. My God, we're talking about the relationship between Israel and all of the Arab countries, between ourselves and Israel, between ourselves and the Arab countries. I mean, for Romney to condemn Obama, who was soberly trying to assess what was happening and say that we all ought to work together to... bring those people to justice who killed the ambassador and the other people in the embassy, is really quite remarkable. As I said in that blog, I have not seen this kind of a dissembling of a candidate before, except perhaps John McCain when Lehman Brothers went under, but that's about it.
Well, it does nothing to enhance Romney's stature in terms of his foreign policy. Nothing.
Well, there's something wrong with this guy. Think about this. Do you know anybody who has an elevator for a car?
I mean, no.
Jennifer Granholm hit it right on the nose where she said, in Romney's world, the cars get the elevators and the workers get the shaft.
And or the escalators, but only going down.
Yeah.
Not
right.
Coming back up. And meanwhile, we observe, of course, Mr. Romney, who, along with Paul Ryan, would hold those taxes the way they are for the rich. And by every measure that I have come across, Ed, every economist that I have read, and I'm not simply reading the ones on the left, but the ones on the right as well, who are saying that if the Romney-Ryan budget plan were to work, the middle class would be paying more taxes, the poor would be suffering more greatly, and the rich would simply get richer. Greater divide between the rich and the poor than any industrialized in many countries in the world. And they, with all the money, pouring all the money into political campaigns, essentially turning our democracy into an oligarchy.
Well, think about the amount of money that we're talking about. It's just incredible when you start to hear figures like $200 million or $300 or $400 million or $1 billion that 50 or 60 of these multi-billionaires can put together to buy the election. We no longer have a democracy. Whatever it is, it's not working very well. But I think that in a presidential year, there's so many people involved and so many people paying attention. It's going to be hard for them to buy this one, but they will sure work hard on those congressional candidates.
The Scott Walker's Act 10, the so-called budget repair bill, went a direct attack on teachers' unions, on public unions, their rights to negotiate. It, in some parts of the state, created something of a divide, but between those who are unionized and those who are not. Now there is a teacher strike down in Chicago.
Right.
Your thoughts on that? You with your law firm, Ed, have worked on behalf of unions in the past. What do you make of that situation? What might it mean for this campaign?
Well, sometimes when you get into negotiations, the negotiators or the parties at the table become bigger than the contracts that they're trying to negotiate. So take someone like Rahm Emanuel, I call Rahm the Rooster, and he is enjoying the spotlight. And it's not really about money. It's not about benefits. It's about privatization of education. He doesn't want to say that, and when the union says it, they poo-poo it. But that's really what's happening. So I think that the problem is that Rahm Emanuel wants to come out of this as the savior of education for those who want to pay for it on a privatized basis.
Well, and some who felt that the way to save American education was to create voucher schools. And yet,
well, exactly.
And yet it seems that vouchers are simply a move toward privatization and gutting and taking away money from public schools, and then you blame the
right.
public schools for not educating well enough while you're taking students and taking money away from them.
Take the money away, class sizes go up, scores go down, and then they say, see, public education is not working, it's the union's fault. Well, the teachers, the union, they know what they're doing, and most of these politicians don't.
And there we have this. I know in the region in northwest Wisconsin, there are voucher schools that have begun, and some of them may be being successful. I can think of one in particular. I don't know if it's the only one, and that's an Ojibwe language immersion school, which is doing very, very well. And in a situation like that, where you may want to move away from, if you're going to do an immersion, it probably need be separate from the rest.
Well, I think we should. We have to start with the feeling that public education is really the bedrock of democracy. I mean, if you take away education from the poor and the middle class and the working class, they're never going to break out of where they are, and they're never going to do better, and they're going to be bitter citizens because they can't participate and compete. So if you start with the assumption that vouchers is going to help more than public education, I think it's an excuse to cut back on the contributions that the state or the local communities are giving to their schools, and it has nothing to do with sound policies with respect to learning.
And few, I think, would argue that one of the best ways to improve the outcomes of a public education system or any educational system is reduce the student-teacher ratio. More
right.
teachers per classroom, smaller class sizes, and you have a better education, and that requires having more teachers. But that as a result, perhaps not a somewhere. I think you can draw a line between Act 10, the budget repair bill, the attack on education, the slashing of the educational budget in Wisconsin by the Walker administration, and you end up with fewer teachers, larger classes. Add to that vouchers, taking students and money away from the schools, but particularly money away from the schools, and we end up with a less effective educational system.
The first time I heard about vouchers for public education in Wisconsin, I was on the weekend program that public television has, and Dave Iverson was the host, and he said, Ed, what do you think about this proposal from Tommy Thompson and Jim Clouser that poor black parents should have the same opportunities as middle-class white parents, so we give them vouchers, they can pick the school that they want to go to. And I still remember my response. I said, anytime Jim Clouser and Tommy Thompson are giving you ideas to help poor blacks, you better tell them to cover their wallets, because it's not designed for the parents and the kids who are suffering. It's designed to cut back on funds from the contributions that they have to make to keep the schools open so they can put it where they want to put it, whether it's in more prisons or whatever.
On with Ed Garvey, EdGarveyFightingBob.com. I'm Eric Shoebring, and David Giffey is with us as well. And yesterday at the state capitol in Madison, well, we'll find out if there were more arrests or what happened there, because joining us is Mike McCabe of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Mike, who's been working for, well, it seems like decades now on the issue of money and politics. Welcome to Fighting Bob Radio, Mike.
Oh, good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Mike. And are you calling from jail? Or are you?
Hey, Ed. I'm a free man.
Okay. That's what you think.
Did you have a permit to protest the money in politics and the legalized bribery that it has become?
Yeah, we arranged to hold the press conference in the assembly parlor, and you know, I also just yesterday I was asked to meet with a delegation of officials from Afghanistan, and met with them in one of the assembly hearing rooms, and I told them that, you know, I could sit with them and I could publicly condemn some of the political practices in our state, and I wouldn't be arrested that day, but if I went down into the rotunda and held up a sign, I probably would be. So we live in odd times.
Well, I never thought I'd see the day when in Wisconsin you couldn't demonstrate within the Capitol. I speculate that they're afraid that Glenn Grossman is going to get an idea and some noise outside might chase it away.
Glenn Grossman, the state senator from West Bend, who, just the other day he called for, he would like to end expansion into energy conservation practices, wind farms and so on.
You could never accuse him of thinking beyond his nose.
I think we call that regressing to the mean spirit.
That's right.
And you know, I once testified before one of his committees, and he lit into me about us posting campaign contributions to members of the legislature on our website, and proceeded to call me a goof. And I thought, well, if you're gonna insult me, you can do better than that. My wife calls me that all the time.
So what did he call you then?
He didn't. I guess that was the best he could come up with.
Well, I think these people have a problem. You know, without the recall to talk about and things like that, they're going to have to start talking about their performance, and it doesn't seem to be too good at this point.
But you know what? This is such bizarre times, you know, and we just held these events in both in the Capitol and in Milwaukee and Green Bay to call attention to a new form of political bribery that's grown up around us, and you know, and all we're really doing is just saying out loud what everybody's thinking, and you know, it's a bizarre time because we've got ethics laws on the books that say that you can't buy a legislator a beer. That's a crime. But you can write out a huge check and hand it right to the legislator, and that's perfectly legal. So, you know, we've got laws that used to protect us from government corruption that now look pretty silly and really aren't worth the paper they're written on. And all these people at the Capitol, all these legislators, seem to think this is all normal and this is just standard operating procedure. You know, we've become way too accepting of and or at least resigned to these huge amounts of money changing hands in politics, and they think that it's just the way it ought to be and the way it's always been, and you know, that just is evidence to me that we live in really bizarre times when you can't buy a legislator a cup of coffee. That's a criminal act, but you can write out a massive check, or you can buy your own ads extolling their virtues and put them up on TV, and that's just fine under the law.
At least they should be able to buy a beer. But you know, I look at this, and I think it was Bob LaFollette who said that they should receive nothing like that, and Phil LaFollette said the reason he never would ask anyone for a cup of coffee is he can afford a cup of coffee himself.
Well,
so,
you know,
they looked at it a little differently.
Well, yeah, you know, and the law says you can't buy anything of value for a legislator, because that could influence them, or it could be seen as a reward for their actions. So you can't buy anything of value. You can't give them anything of value, but the definition doesn't include campaign contributions. Well, nowadays, what could be of greater value to your average politician than a campaign contribution? And so it's just amazing how ridiculously outdated and obsolete our ethics laws have become, and these people are operating as if all of this is just normal. And you know, somebody's got to say this isn't normal. This is not what you had in Wisconsin for a century, and this isn't the way Wisconsin politics should work.
Wouldn't you love to be in on the orientation programs for the freshman assemblymen and state senators?
Well, they work magic on these people, because I'll tell you, the one thing that strikes me the most is the difference between a freshman legislator and a second-term legislator. You know, they really do work on the way they think, and they indoctrinate them into the capital political culture. They really must work some magic on them, because it's amazing the difference.
I was shocked when I heard that if a new member of Congress is elected, the first thing that happens is that the party recommends a fundraiser for him, and the second thing is a public relations person. Then they tell the freshman, this is the time to hold a big fundraising event, because those who voted for you will support you. Those who voted against you are going to be scared of you, so they'll give you some money. So that's essentially what the idea is, to get elected to the House of Representatives. You're just going to have people raising money for you every day.
Mike McCabe, describe the difference that you see between a freshman and a second-term state legislator. What, for example? What does it look like?
Well, you know, first of all, they come in with a great deal of ambition. They come in with the idea that they've got a to-do list. They have things that they want to do for their constituents. Well, the first thing that they're told is to sit down, shut up, don't introduce any bills, don't put your name on anything, we'll tell you how to vote, and you keep your head down, and we'll get you reelected, and once you've been in for a couple, three terms, then you're cemented, then your career is safe. You know, so that's the first thing, is they come in with the idea that they're going to represent their constituents, and they're soon convinced that what they really have to do is take marching orders from the leadership. Second thing is that they often come in with the idea that politics is sick, that it's diseased, that there needs to be some change. And by their second term, it's amazing how many of them have cooled, or sometimes grown very cold toward the idea of reform. And it's just it's the most striking thing when you can talk to somebody in their first term, and it's like talking to a regular person, and you talk to them in their second term, and they've become part of the capital culture, it's the darndest thing to watch.
Where does the money come in? When what about the campaign financing? Is that a part of that process, or is it the party?
Oh, of course it is. Yeah. You know, because one of the things they find is that it's a lot easier to raise money when you're in office, because suddenly people who never had any interest in you have interest in you, because you actually have a vote on those matters, and suddenly you know, people who never wanted to come to a fundraiser, people who never had any interest, didn't even know who you were, they suddenly know who you are, and they suddenly are real interested in you, and they suddenly want to build relationships. And of course, a lot of those relationships get built or, you know, lubricated by campaign contributions. And so, you know, they find that they suddenly are really prolific fundraisers, and they didn't think that they could do much of that before. And
those freshmen,
they start to get addicted to it.
Those freshmen, pretty soon, if they complain about the money, the leadership tells them to be quiet. Shut up. We're not going to unilaterally disarm. We've got to get as much money as they get. So you read all these stories now about the Obama campaign and the Romney campaign. And there's nothing in the lead story I say about policy. It was who outraised who for the past month, and Obama sneaked ahead of the Republicans by about $2 million. Well, I don't think people are voting based on how many millions of dollars you raise. They would like to hear people explain their policies. But those consultants who are working with, and they get paid out of the money that is contributed, they will tell every candidate, listen, you only win by getting more television spots than the other guy. And, by the way, I get 15% of every TV spot we buy.
Yeah, you're listening to Fighting Bob Radio on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Eric Shubrey, and, of course, with Ed Garvey of FightingBob.com. And guest today is Mike McCabe of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Yesterday, part of a news conference in the state capitol. No, he did not get arrested. You had a permit. But as you said, Mike, if you had stepped out into the rotunda with a sign, you'd have been in trouble. But they probably would have gotten a ticket at home. I don't quite understand that.
Well, apparently what's happening, Eric, is that they started out by arresting a few people, and they were actually writing out citations right on the spot, but found that was causing even a bigger stir when they were writing out these citations. And so they decided that what they would do instead is just sort of take names and addresses and then send them the citations so that there wasn't as much confrontation, or it didn't cause as much of a stir right in the building. But they continue to, you know, they continue to either arrest people or fine people for doing as little as just holding up a sign. Now, some people have come with the language from Wisconsin's Constitution that says that the right to peaceably assemble and petition your government shall never be abridged. And the, you know, the Constitution says never. You know, it doesn't say it can be abridged if you don't have a permit. It just says that it shall never be abridged. And some people have taken to coming with signs that have that language on there, and they're getting fined for holding it up.
And I don't know how to say this exactly, but I think we should be a little angrier than we are. I mean, this is an outrage. There was a fundraiser to be held in a private home in Racine where Ryan was supposed to show up, and they scattered them and said they were going to arrest people unless they left, because there's an ordinance in Racine, the city, that you cannot picket an individual's home. Well, how in the world do they interpret that?
And I think, Ed, you hit the nail on the head. People have become too accepting,
mm-hmm.
And too resigned to these kinds of practices. And, you know, whether it's the large sums of money that are changing hands in politics, or whether it's attempts to stifle dissent or disrupt or interfere with legitimate protest. These are actions that are repugnant. They're actions that have no place in an actual democracy. And people should be not only deeply distressed, but they should be ticked off about it.
Yeah.
And too many people are just sort of shrugging, and they're kind of ho-hum about these things that are happening. Voter suppression is another example. For the life of me, I cannot understand how people don't see the voter ID law as the reincarnation of a poll tax. If you don't have a state-issued photo ID, To get one, you have to have a copy of your birth certificate, and if you don't have one of those, it'll cost you $20 to get a copy. And if you're a married woman and you no longer have your maiden name, your birth certificate's going to have a different name on it than you currently have, and so you're going to need your marriage license, your marriage certificate as well. That'll cost you $20. Well, the poll tax that was outlawed during the civil rights era, I looked this up. If you looked at it in today's dollars, that poll tax was $10.64. And it was outlawed as an unconstitutional infringement on the right to vote. And now we've got a situation where there are people who might have to pay $40 to get the documentation that they need to be able to participate in an election. How is that not a poll tax? And I don't understand why people have suddenly become tolerant of behavior that voter suppression tactics that were deemed unconstitutional and that were outlawed a generation ago.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And when you think about John Lewis and the Mississippi burning, the three young men who were killed, they were trying to get people registered to vote. I mean, that was the idea. When we started a voter registration drive in Mississippi, Bob Moses was heading the campaign, and the first two people he brought in to register, the sheriff pistol whipped to the two people and Bob Moses. I mean, so these people risked their lives to have the right to vote, and then we get politicians who say, well, let's just take it away.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's clear that those politicians are in large part the Republican Party, Wisconsin, Scott Walker, the Fitzgeralds. Van Hollen has asked the state Supreme Court to take another look and do so quickly. Kennedy of the Government Accountability Board has said no, don't review it now because there would not be time both for people to get IDs if they could at the cost that you're suggesting might occur, Mike, and that there wouldn't be time to train poll workers in what ID is.
Why do I have this feeling that we have another Florida 2000 on our hands, or Ohio from 4 years ago? It just seems to me that they're lining up right now to challenge the entire election. So even if Obama wins, he could be in the courts for a year or two. Now, they wouldn't want to do it right now because Obama's the president, but it sure would take the starch out of a lot of the campaigns that we're waging now to get people out to vote.
Well, and the argument in Pennsylvania is that some 750,000 persons would be disenfranchised in this election as a result of the voter ID law there, and yet it might likely be upheld, and that's the way it will be. And what a tragedy! What an affront!
Absolutely.
To the notion of democracy.
This is David Giffey here.
Yeah, David Giffey, welcome.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Mike.
Hi, David.
Hi, David.
Eric. Hello. Listen, I totally agree with you, Mike, about the kind of apathetic populace that we seem to be surrounded with and hopefully not participating in ourselves. But I also want to suggest that the climate of fear is pervasive these days, where people have been kind of indoctrinated by propaganda emanating from the things like the war on terror and so forth, to feel that almost everything that they might do even in a legitimate protest, it could be misconstrued to be provocative or something like that, and so while yes we are apathetic, we are also terrorized ourselves by ourselves by just a presence of fear.
Absolutely. If you think you're going to go vote and run the risk of being arrested for fraud, you're probably going to stay home.
Well, these are times that these are times politically that aren't for the faint of heart, and these are times when people do need to muster the courage to act. And you know, when I met with this Afghan delegation yesterday. A number of them made comments through their interpreter that were unmistakable. They're not real impressed with what they've seen so far of American democracy.
Well, shame on them.
they made it pretty plain that what they see has been sort of underwhelming to them. And I just told them to trust their eyes. No, the thing that was sad, the thing that was saddest to me was afterwards, a number of them said through their interpreter that you know, they had been in Washington D.C. They'd met with a bunch of people there. They're in Wisconsin. They're going to, you know, they're going to Wyoming and then to Florida. But so far, that I had been the only person that said anything about the condition of democracy in this country that was consistent with what they were seeing.
Is
and
that
I thought,
right?
Now, and I said, how sad is that? That
mm-hmm.
that nobody has been willing to tell them that we've got serious problems here from 196 people supplying 80% of the money that these super PACs are raising and spending to buy a presidential election, to voter suppression that you're seeing in state after state. Nobody was willing to say to them that, you know, that we've got some serious threats here, and I just thought that I guess it was kind of a compliment in a way, but it was so pathetic that you know, you can't take it as a compliment.
Listen, you should listen to Romney. He said, "Don't apologize. We're the greatest country. We're the greatest country in the world. So don't even think about apologizing."
Well, and Mike, you're describing people from Afghanistan, where it is clearly understood by all that the regime of Hamid Karzai in that country are wildly corrupt.
Oh, and they came right out and said, you know, these were officials. Some of them were you know, journalists. You know, some of them were election officials. Some of them were were members of the assembly there. And they acknowledged that Afghanistan is known as one of the most corrupt places on earth. And one of the things they said is that we've never really had an opportunity to build something from the ground up, that we keep having things imposed on us from the top down. And one of the questions they asked me is, where does real change come from? Does it come from the grassroots up, or does it come from leaders top down? And I said, well, first of all, when you think about leaders, those in power, when you think of the ruling class, I've never met a class of people who are less involved in leadership than those in the ruling class. You know, they don't move a muscle without consulting a poll or conducting a focus group. And real change has always come from the grassroots. It's always been forced on the so-called leaders, by whether it was the civil rights movement or regardless of what change. You know, women didn't get the right to vote because there were, you know, male leaders who decided that it needed to be so. You know, the suffragettes had to march, and they had to work for decades. And slavery didn't get abolished because, you know, suddenly the white leaders in Washington had pangs of conscience. They, you know, people fought and died to end that injustice. And you know, Ed knows this better than anybody about the sacrifices that were made during the civil rights era. Those changes had to be forced on the ruling class. They weren't, that change wasn't given voluntarily. And the same will go with the kind of corruption that we have in our system today. We won't have suddenly people on high saying, you know, hey, we got to turn in a different direction. They'll only turn when they're forced to turn.
Look at David Prosser.
Exactly. Well, you know, look at a whole bunch of cast of characters there that keep doing the bidding of the rich and powerful, and they, you know, they're taking their cues from those who have a stranglehold over the system, and that's not going to change unless people force it to change.
Can I cut off for just a minute?
Sure.
There are a number of breakout sessions coming up at Fighting Bob Fest, which is the day after tomorrow, with the kickoff tomorrow night at the Goodman Center. The Fighting Bob Fest itself, a day-long event with you, Mike, as on the Citizens United panel with Norm Solomon and John Matthews, I believe, and maybe and many others, many participants. I also, though, wanted to mention that in regard to the indignation that we look for about things that are unfolding here, there's a breakout session on the next generation and the progressive movement, and I think one of the panelists was someone who was actually arrested this week at the Capitol as a protester, Arthur Cole Riggs. This is a panel that's made up of young folks who are hopefully defining the progressive movement of the future. So we have a lot to look forward to in that regard too. And maybe at some point we want to run down the schedule. What, Mike? Tell us about the Citizens United panel, the breakout session. How do you foresee this?
Well, you know, I as for my participation, you know, I'll have a small role to play in fighting Bob Fest. There's some great headliner speakers, and I know there's some wonderful breakout sessions, and Fighting Bob Fest is really always about all the energy that all those participants, all those in attendance bring to that event. And, you know, I'll have a small role to play there. For my part, you know, I think it's important both to understand what Citizens United is doing to us, what its implications are, and you know, I think a lot of people just assume, well, you know, pipelines have been opened that are allowing unprecedented amounts of corporate money to flow in. Well, that's true enough, but there are other effects that we're seeing of Citizens United, and so I think part of it is to help people come to terms with how Citizens United is damaging us, and then turn to how you work around Citizens United in the short term and how you undermine and ultimately lead to that ruling finding its way into the trash bin of history over the longer haul. So that, for my part, that's what I want to focus on.
Could we pretend, this is a totally facetious comment in a way, but that we were actually writing legislation and we would start putting numbers on campaign contributions, for example. What would be your ideal, Mike?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that we're trying to call attention to is obsolete ethics laws. One of the things that we can do is start to redefine political bribery in a meaningful modern context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people a generation ago or a century ago, none of them could imagine $81 million elections for governor. None of them could imagine multi-million dollar elections for a seat in the legislature. They didn't see campaign contributions playing the role that they're playing today. And so we have to have laws that begin to redefine bribery in a modern context and put some teeth back in our ethics laws. That is something that should be pressed. And that's a way to confront Citizens United in a very practical, short-term way. Public financing of elections remains constitutional. Public financing plans that work around Citizens United in the short term can be pressed. New York State and New York City are doing a great job of pressing forward. Why Wisconsin is not showing more signs of leadership is beyond me, but you know, that's some place where we can push greater disclosure that at least creates accountability for these mass
spenders.
Well,
it's also constitutional.
Also completely constitutional. So there are great reforms that can be done. Corporate accountability and shareholder rights legislation could be pressed. If corporations are going to spend all this money, shouldn't the human beings who supply capital to those corporations have some say in how their money's used? Shouldn't they be informed of that spending, and shouldn't they be able to either bless it or deny a corporation the ability to use their money in that way? That would be constitutional. That could be pushed. And then, of course, over the long haul, we either need to amend the Constitution or get a new Supreme Court eventually that will see this ruling as the folly it is and overturn it. Or both. That's right.
You listen to Fighting
Bob
Radio.
I think you're right.
Ed Garvey. Go ahead, Ed, please.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out who we should be talking to in the state of Wisconsin to get them
to do something about public financing and disclosure and so on. I mean, the governor's clearly not going to do anything. I haven't heard any peeps out of the Democrats in the legislature either. So I hope that these last elections, perhaps we have some new voices in there that might say, you know, this is bad no matter which party you belong to. It's bad when you've got lobbyists telling us when bills can be brought up, who drafts them. I mean, the mining bill, for example, we couldn't find out who drafted the bill. For heaven's sake, you know that was Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, but they wouldn't admit it.
Well,
that's
Ed, I remember prior to the recall election, you said you thought it was you were very concerned about the notion of a recall, that putting all of that effort and all of that money
mm-hmm.
recall election. Even more recently, I've heard people looking back, whether it's Chris Hedges, for example, would say that what happened in Wisconsin was a mistake. We put it back into the electoral process, that whole issue of
yeah.
Governor Walker's actions, and that in the minds of many was a mistake. A mistake perhaps because of the money, perhaps just putting it into the electoral process, which we seem to be describing here, Mike, with money in politics, with the corporate elite and the oligarchy that seems to be controlling the electoral process, either through voter ID laws and restrictive voting and voter suppression, or just the amount of money that gets poured in, that the electoral process doesn't work. Some say there should have been not an election last year, and it's a big, big jump, but a general strike. Must we put ourselves really on the street in order to change things, or can we expect the electoral process and the government process to work on our behalf?
Well,
it's not working now.
What I can say, Eric, is that the electoral process won't work if there's not at least one party that is committed to real change. And if there's a party in control, if there's a party in power that is corrupt, but there's not a forceful and a truly appealing alternative to that, then voters have nowhere to go. And you know, and with the I can't tell you how many people I've heard from since the recall election. They said, look, you know, the people did their part. They marched. They went out on street corners and they gathered signatures. But then it got turned over to the ruling class. It got turned over to the political people, and that's when it all fell flat, because there wasn't a compelling alternative presented, and that, you know, the electoral process is going to be with us, and I don't think we can write it off. Now, I'm not advocating against other actions. I'd be the last person to do that, but in as much as we've got an electoral process, we need one, if not two, parties that actually show some commitment to serving the public interest and promoting the common good, and not simply catering to the 1% of the population that provides most all of the campaign money. And that's the rut that we're stuck in, is we don't have anybody out there. And so I think Ed's exactly right. We need sort of new faces and new voices to rise up that will challenge that gridlock that comes with people who are so hopelessly beholden to these wealthy donors.
There's got to be an answer to it, and I think part of it's exposure. If we're not going to get the Government Accountability Board or others to force these contributors to come up with money, we're going to have to do some investigative work ourselves, buy some TV spots and put it up there and say, here's what's happening with this corporation. And we've got to do something beyond just the electoral process, because one of the pitfalls of Citizens United is that so many good people, so many young people, when you ask them, will you run for office, they say, well, hell no, because there's no way I could raise the kind of money that I need in order to make a splash. So we're caught no matter which way we turn.
Well, it seems that we may have plenty of fodder for a good television campaign. I'm thinking about Pennsylvania with the 750,000 people who some say will be disenfranchised as a result of voter ID law. And you had a Republican state legislator there saying, we've done it. We've instituted campaign ID, and that will give Pennsylvania to Mitt Romney. One would think all you'd have to do would be to run that statement by that man, and it, you'd think it would sway people to understand that that party is trying to rig the election.
See, I think people know that. Mike, help me here with the figures, but I think when we were surveys 8 and 10 years ago, I think it was like 90% of the people in Wisconsin believed in public financing campaigns. I mean, I think they get the message. They know the system's corrupt and it's broken. Now the question is, how do you get past the politicians who are standing in the door, in the doorstep, to make sure that the people can't get through to real reform?
That's exactly correct. Yeah. In fact, we had a statewide referendum in Wisconsin asking people how they felt about campaign finance reform, and 90% of the voters voted for it, and the elected officials turned right around and ignored it and did nothing.
Exactly.
So that's exactly right. The people get it. And it crosses the political spectrum. When you look at polls about how people feel about Citizens United, it's amazing. Just as many Republicans and independents as Democrats believe that Citizens United was wrongly decided, that it's a disastrous ruling, that it's dead wrong for America. And super majorities across the spectrum, Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike, believe that super PACs should be outlawed. And yet what are the parties doing? They're creating new super PACs every day.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe we should, if you've got some money, Mike, I'll create the PAC for you.
I was gonna say, I got plenty of messages if somebody's got some money.
There's a great economist, David Corton, who once taught at Harvard University in the business school there, and now he, among other things, he publishes a magazine called Yes Magazine, and he pointed out recently in an article and a number of books that when wealth and power are concentrated at the top, the result is not trickle up, it is a sucking up. Things get sucked up to the top, that it is this great division between the rich and the poor, this huge division that makes the Gilded Age almost looks like equality, that if we don't change that, if you don't bring the rich down, begin to tax them fairly, they simultaneously restrict campaign contributions and change Citizens United, we're in trouble. But it is that division between rich and poor, the poor who are rarely, you should note, ever mentioned anymore. It's the middle class, I came across.
The poor have disappeared, apparently.
Apparently. The middle class, by the numbers, is somewhere between $80,000 and $120,000 a year family income. I must tell you, that is a rare family in Northwest Wisconsin who is a member of the middle class.
Yeah,
you know,
that's for
funny.
Sure.
It's funny, Eric. Every time we have another election, you know, we had $44 million spent last summer in 2011 on 9 Senate recall elections. Then we had $81 million spent on the governor's race and millions more on the Senate recalls. And I keep getting these calls from reporters saying, don't you think there will be donor fatigue here pretty quick? And don't you think the well will run dry? What people don't get, I keep saying that, you know, the one sector of the economy that's recession-proof is the political economy. You know,
that's right.
In 2010, 93% of all income growth in America went to the top 1%. 93% of all income growth went to the top 1% in 2010.
So they're not getting tired of the system the way it is.
Exactly. So you count up all the donors on our database, all the donors to Wisconsin campaigns, it amounts to about 1% of the population. So, it's so simple. You look at who's given all the money. These are not people who are suffering. These are people who've sucked up all the income growth. They keep funneling this money into these campaigns to keep buying the very same policies that haven't worked for 30 years.
And they're not giving the money. They're investing the money.
And they're getting a hell of a return on their investment.
Exactly.
They sure are.
So we have a Democratic Party, which some say has become useless, a Republican Party, which is more clearly bought and sold. Fighting Bob Festival on Saturday, there are going to be 5 plus to 10,000 people there. Do we put them on the streets, Ed? Do we ask them to march?
I don't know. My hero Jim Hightower is going to be there. I was with Hightower traveling around the country, and somebody said, Jim, do you think we need a third party? He said, hell, I'd settle for a second one.
Yeah.
So maybe,
you know, at Fighting Bob,
I
want to just let people know that the first several hundred people that show up at Fighting Bob Fest in the morning on Saturday at the Alliance Center in Madison will receive free copies of Bidding for Power, which is a book written by you, Ed.
Yeah, and it's really worth it if you don't have to pay for it.
Ed, did you just write that yesterday during this election cycle?
Actually, we published it during the campaign with Tommy Thompson, the People's Band.
Oh,
how about those guys? They won't reveal their income taxes now. I mean, it's quite remarkable, it seems to me. Think about Mitt Romney admitting he has money in Swiss banks and in the Cayman Islands. Can you believe that? I mean, I think that even Joe Kennedy would have grimaced at that.
Would have tried to hide that fact, yeah. Well, it's legal, however. Apparently, still legal.
But it's improper.
Fighting Bob Radio on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Eric Schubert, of course, host Ed Garvey, and today Mike McCabe of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and journalist David Giffey, who's been doing, more than yeoman work on the Fighting Bob Festival Saturday, David.
Well, I'm only one of many who, believe me, it's astounding to realize what the forces of humanity that pull the Fighting Bob Fest together every year. It's quite astounding. I think it'd be hopeless to quickly run through the schedule. Ed, you want to do that, or should?
Well, sure. Why don't we start Friday night? We'll have Daniel Kanini, who's our favorite poet. South African who was expelled from South Africa during apartheid. He's going to be reading a poem on peace. And Jim Hightower will be there, and nobody beats Jim. And Norman Solomon will introduce Phil Donahue, and Donahue will talk about the movie, The Body of War, that he has produced. And finally, we end up with Greg Palast and John Nichols. So it's going to be quite a day. That's just Friday.
And Saturday, that's at 149 Wabisa Street in Madison, the Goodman
so Google
Community
it before Street. You get to Madison.
Yeah.
Many people don't know where the Goodman Center is. So Google it or whatever, 149 Wabisa Street. If you need directions, call us at 256-1003.
Well, I know that we up here in the north are particularly excited about the mining panel that one of the breakout sessions with Mike Wiggins, Jr., the chair of the Bad River Tribe, Al Geddix, the Wisconsin Resources Protection Council. I know Frank Kane, activist up here, who's been very much involved in doing education about the proposed mining district here, proposed by an out-of-state company, and at the behest of them, legislation being probably written by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and dutifully parroted by the Republicans in the legislature, and excited too about Bill McKibben, Ed.
Bill McKibben is going to be here, and I just think his timing could not be better. So we're really looking forward to seeing him again. He spoke at BobFest a couple of years ago, and boy, his message is finally getting through. Greg Palast will be here. Buddy Romer, if you remember Buddy Romer, he's going to be here. He talked about campaign finance reform as he tried to run for president, and the Republicans wouldn't even let him on the stage. So he's got a clear message to tell us about that. So it's going to be quite a day.
The morning speakers on Saturday at the Alliance Center in Madison, it'll start off with yourself, Ed, and Dave Zweifel and Ruth Conniff, co-host, welcoming and introducing Tammy Baldwin, who's running for the Senate. And then there'll be music throughout the day and food and beverages of note. Peter Leidy's going to perform in the morning. Malin Mitchell will speak. Buddy Romer, you mentioned Stan Grzynski. The Raging Grannies.
Mike Papantonio.
Jim Hightower, these are all in the morning, and then in the afternoon, what else is happening?
Well, Gwen Moore speaks right about 1 o'clock, and then we've got Donahue and Norman Solomon again, and Buddy Romer and Stan, so it's going to be quite an afternoon as well.
Yeah.
John Nichols will sum things up at the end, and that will be a great speech.
And Dr. Jill Stein will be there, Juan Cole.
Dr. Jill Stein, that's a good one.
Yeah, Terry O'Neill, the president of the National Organization of Women. So a lot of bases are covered this next day and a half.
Well, I look forward to seeing you down there. We need you in Madison, so get in your car and come on down.
Everybody needs to be. And of course,
I have to run right now, but thanks very much.
Be well, Ed. Thank you. Ed Garvey leaving us, but David, a great lineup. And Mike, I mean, this gap between the rich and the poor, and the money coming for politics from the rich, it's a tough task, isn't it?
It is, and you know, we've basically been embarked on a 3-decade-long experiment here in this country with trickle-down economics, and it hasn't worked for 30 years. The country's grown apart rather than grown together. It's the rich have gotten richer, the middle class has been slowly but surely exterminated. It hasn't made our country more prosperous, yet we continue to have these policies. And if anything, you've got politicians saying that we really just need to double down on those policies. And you know, it's hard for me not to see how, you know, you count up the number of contributors, and what you see is that the contributors equal about 1% of the population, and you can then see why we've got economic policies that disproportionately benefit the top 1%. Well, that's the root of the problem, and you know, if you try to chop at the branch of evil that is income equality, but you don't strike at the root, which is the political corruption that produced these policies, then the branch is just going to grow back, and that's exactly what we've seen for 3 decades now. Is the branch keeps growing because we haven't been able to strike at the root of these policies, and that's the political corruption that leads too many politicians on both sides to continue to buy into policies that haven't worked for 30 years.
And with that diminishing percentage of contributors to political campaigns, it absolutely must have a chilling effect on the constituency as well, in so far as voter turnout. I mean, the numbers of people who go to the polls are reduced, probably proportionate to the vast wealth that is being exercised at the top to buy the politicians.
Well, you know, Ed made the point before about if you ask a group of kids who wants to run for political office, and I've said many times that if you want to know anything about the health of democracy, all you really need to know, you can learn by just going into a high school classroom or a college classroom and just ask them how many of them are thinking of running for public office, and they look at you like you're from outer space, because they just assume that they can't possibly have that kind of voice. They can't possibly come up with the money that would be needed to be competitive. And there's a tremendous loss to our society when you have so many people who are effectively priced out of the political marketplace and can't contemplate stepping forward and offering themselves up for a position of leadership. And that's, you know, that's central to the, you know, to the mess that we're in, is that we've got so many people who just have become convinced that their voices don't count, that their votes don't even matter, because the politicians are simply going to listen to those who supply them with all the money. And we've got to strike at that root.
Mike, I listened carefully to, I punished myself, I guess, listened to the campaigns, both the Republican National Convention and the Democrats as well. The Republican Convention was tedious at best, frustrating frequently, and duplicitous, at least disingenuous, I think, often, in particular, Paul Ryan. The Democratic campaign was, the speeches were uplifting, powerful. They seemed as they spoke strongly to my sense of justice. But the sense is, and I'm sure it is of many, and when I would talk with others in this area about what I saw and heard, some of them scoffed at me and said, yeah, but, you know, so what? And I could not help but agree that, that yes, it sounds great, but will they walk the walk, or is it simply talk? Is it simply rhetoric? Given that disaffection, I mean, we're sometimes treated like this is like being in an abusive relationship, you know? And we only have about a minute, I'm sorry, but if you have a thought, Mike.
Well, you know, that's the central problem, is that, you know, the only thing that really speaks is action. And if there's nobody in the political class who's really willing to act in a way that produces real change, then people just grow more and more cynical about the words that they hear, the talk that they hear. And at some point, there's got to be a political party emerge that is serious about acting on the major problems that face our country. And it's not sustainable to have a situation where the number of people who are politically homeless, the number of people who do not feel that they can call themselves either Democrats or Republicans, is at its highest level in 75 years.
Let's talk about this more tomorrow night at 149 Wabisha Street at the Goodman Center at 6 o'clock, Fighting Bob Fest kickoff, and at 8:45 Saturday at the Alliant Energy Center.
And it is the Fighting Bob Festival, at which time it's an opportunity for people to take action with others. Thank you very much, Mike McCabe. Keep up the good work at the Democracy Campaign.
My pleasure, as always. Great talking with you.
Thanks for listening. Everything's archived. You can listen to it archived. Fighting Bob Radio, fightingbob.com. Look there. Thanks for tuning in.